Earth News, episode number 18, July the 19th, 2009. Okay, time to do some introductions. Things have been changed around a bit. We are very, very happy to say that we've managed to get a guest to join us on the show today. I'm Croc Kamen. I'm seated next to me is our usual...
Tom Holder from West News, obviously, as well.
And joining us, if you could introduce yourself...
I'm Tess. I run the website denonet.com, which no one has ever heard of.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, tell us a bit of why you wanted to join the show.
Well, basically, I was working on an enterprise integration project this week. I am currently in Berlin, although I am from Minnesota in the U.S., so you might hear the occasional Mystery Science Theater joke out of me. And I was listening to your podcast earlier, and when you had mentioned that you might want to have a guest on, I considered, well, I like OS News. I've been following it for years, and I like the podcast. Maybe I could have something to add. And then I thought about it a little bit more and said, no, that's ridiculous. I don't want to add myself to it and make a whole big mess and embarrass myself and everyone else. And while I was working at this enterprise integration project, I had a few minutes of downtime while something was compiling. Kind of looked at myself in the third person at that time, going, yeah, I have a problem.
Now, we appreciate that you can add a different set of skills and opinion to this. As we had said in the podcast, we're not really looking for amazing skills, and I suspect that you do have amazing skills besides anyway. We're specializing a bit more in Linux than what than I certainly do, or maybe Tom has.
Yeah, I'm not particularly versed in the whole thing. I just use it and then just muddle through, basically. But Tess really seems to have a lot of knowledge on stuff that we have absolutely, that we as in me and Croc, have absolutely no idea what we're talking about. So that's probably a very good addition to the show, basically.
With that, let's march forward and get on with the usual format. By the way, did we have any emails at all? I can't remember what feedback we had on the last show. We should look at that.
We had a lot of comments, I think. We didn't have any emails, well, except obviously from Tess, who wanted to join. But
yes.
But we handled that already. Let me see.
No, you're quite right. We did get a lot of comments.
Yeah, let me see. I'm not entirely sure. Yeah, there's one thing that I want to talk about, and that's the bit about interruptions during the show, because that could use some explanations, because he is actually right that there's a reason for that one that I want to talk about.
Oh, yes.
That's kind of... where is that comment?
It's at the bottom. It's Quan E.
Oh yeah, it's Quan E, and he writes, "Let the man speak," is his called his comment. He says, "I myself wouldn't mind being part of the podcast, but I would think most of my comments would be when Tom interrupts Croc again and again with the same points spoken faster. From God's, let the man speak." I'm not interrupting him because I'm rude or anything, but the problem is that different languages use different cues to indicate that the speaker has ended his turn. It's kind of my turf. I'm into the whole linguistics thing and studying texts and how people, and conversation analysis and that sort of thing. But every language has its own set of cues that indicate that a speaker is nearing the end of his turn. The problem is that in Dutch, those cues are different than they are in English. So even though I'm relatively proficient in English, these are very, very fine details of a language that you don't pick up very easily, especially not when you don't have to use the language very often. I mean, before we started the whole podcast, I barely had to actually speak in English. I mean, I did everything in writing, so right now I'm really trying to adapt to the fact that English uses different cues and in a different way, and to make matters worse, I can't actually see any of the people I'm speaking with. I only see like a screen in front of me with text, but I don't see Croc's facial expressions, I don't see his gestures or anything, so it's really difficult for me to really know when someone's about to end his turn, so mistakes are bound to occur, basically. So that's basically what I wanted to say on that one.
And that we have a certain amount of lag in the connection that's going to make that difficult, as well as the fact that absolutely nothing's planned. We've got no set points that we're covering, so one can just drag on and on with a discussion, and we have to interject each other in order to get our word in.
Yeah, in addition to that, exactly. So it's kind of it's not because I'm rude or anything. It's just that it's kind of difficult speaking in a language that technically isn't your own, even though it's my proficiency is, without arrogance, pretty good. It's never going to be as good as, you know, being a native speaker. So that's what I wanted to say about that one.
Our first article is looking at just the main big news that happened this week. There wasn't a huge amount on the homepage, but it's Tom's long awaited Amiga OS 4.1 review and the demo board that you provided.
Yeah, basically, how many pages? 5 pages of stuff. So I don't really have a whole lot to add. What I can talk about, at least from my perspective, is the response to the article, which has been quite positive, actually. A lot of discussion even on Amiga boards that I also frequent, at least whenever OS News writes about the Amiga, just to see whatever the Amiga community itself is saying. And the response has been fairly positive. They realize that, because I'm completely new to the whole Amiga thing, that there are problems, and a lot of people are willing to, you know, to concede that there could be some improvements made when it comes to the, what do you call it, when it comes to making the Amigos a bit more inviting, a little less daunting when you are a new user. And there, a lot of people are very open about that in the community, but there are obviously, understandably, also people who say, well, the community is small enough as it is, and by changing aspects of the Amiga OS that are normal to diehard Amiga users, you're just going to push those users away, and there aren't a whole lot of those people left. So the argument kind of, you know, goes both ways. I mean, it's probably really difficult to get new users anyway, so why would you focus on that? So that was an interesting thing that came out of this whole review, I think.
I've not personally had much use of Amiga. I unfortunately missed most of that. It was just too expensive in the UK, and it all died out far too quickly, I think. And I was still using Commodore 64, I think, right up until I was about 12, and then still regularly until 16 before I switched over to PC. So I missed that stopgap in between and didn't get the opportunity to try out Amiga. So, like yourself, didn't get to try it out in the day when we'd have had a better understanding of these idiosyncrasies, as you put it.
Yeah, well, but still, I mean, despite the fact that the people who say that are, of course, have a point, at the same time, many of these, idiosyncrasies, as I call them, they come from a world that just doesn't exist anymore. Like, for instance, snapshotting, and especially the fact that Windows don't auto-update. It's because, you know, back then it would cost too much power, processor-wise and memory-wise, to keep automatically updating contents of floppy or whatever. So it didn't have auto-update. And while that may have made sense 25 years ago, it doesn't make any sense anymore now. So you could call it a feature, but I don't necessarily think it's a feature. It's a limitation. A limitation that doesn't make sense anymore, and limitations that don't make sense, you remove those. That's, you know, that's progress. And you can call that getting closer to Windows, but I think that's absolute nonsense. It's just modernizing your operating system and not keeping things that made sense 25 years ago. You know, those things don't make sense anymore right now. So, you know.
We should, of course, ask Tess. You are part of this conversation. Have you had any experience with Amiga? This is probably not the best article to start on for yourself, of course, but we've just got to take whatever there is.
I've had only limited experience with the Amiga. The only time I ever ran into it was actually after its heyday, when I worked very briefly at a cable television channel's doing a lot of back-end support with their systems, and mostly web development work at that time, way, way two lifetimes ago for me. And I didn't actually see that much really improve. I've been fascinated by the Amiga OS. It just seems, though, that if they're not really willing to make a lot of the changes necessary to draw new users in, your operating system is not really going to go anywhere anymore, unless if you're already the tour de force.
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
That's kind of the point that, indeed, that I was trying to make in the article, that while those features may make sense to Amiga users that you have now, diehard Amiga users are a dying breed. I mean, those people are dying out, basically. And I mean, the Amiga is nice, but it's reaching, you know, the point of the BOS, where it's still fun to play around with it every now and then until Haiku gets anywhere. I mean, it's just basically a toy. I mean, it's not, you can't do everything with it that you can do with another operating system, which means that you will be bleeding users. And in order to get them back, you gotta make changes. You can't keep going on and on on the same set of features in the same basic operating system without making any improvements. And I know that's but it is. I do concede that it's a very difficult situation. Like I just explained, that you've got this diehard group of users who are basically right now the only people actually spending money on the whole Amiga scene, and you can't really push those users away by making too many changes. So it is kind of a weird situation for them there. I can see that. So, but then again, maybe they should. I believe that there is a way to make the Amiga more modern without the Amiga losing its special feel. Because, I mean, Apple was able to do it with Mac OS X. Obviously, Apple is a much bigger company. I mean, the comparison, of course, doesn't really go through that well. But the Amiga, Mac OS X, I mean, if you've ever used the classic Mac OS 9, the overall feel is still more or less the same. It operates in the same way. It has the same defining features that set it apart from other operating systems. So I think it is possible. I mean, the Amiga developers won't be able to do it as easily as Apple has done it, and they won't be able to make as many changes or as many radical changes, because obviously they don't have the monetary funds for that. But I still think there's a lot of room for improvement in the operating system, in making it more modern and more friendly to newcomers without losing the special Amiga feel. I mean, I'm sure that you could probably do the same thing with the BOS without losing the special feel of the BOS, so why wouldn't you be able to do the same thing with the Amiga operating system? I think that's certainly possible.
No, I agree with you completely. And the problem is, of course, as you said, the developers, you don't have enough of them to really sustain that kind of effort. If you really want to recast the entire operating system into a more modern light, you're going to have to consider virtualizing legacy support and then creating all new APIs. And you're looking at a multi-year project already just to get started with developing a new OS. And that's if you don't decide to use the cheat and use something that's already on the shelf, a new OS kernel or something else that you can pull off in a download and an open source link, and then put that as the core of your OS and then just build everything around it.
The additional problem there is that there are already other projects in the Amiga world that are actually doing that. I mean, Ados is actually exactly that. It's an open source implementation. It uses the UAE emulator. I always forget the acronym, but like, it uses that special emulator, or I'm not entirely sure if it's an emulator or a virtualizer, but anyway. It uses that to be able to run older Amiga software so that they can modernize the actual ADOS operating system. And MorphOS is doing something similar, but I get the idea that MorphOS is sticking closer to the original Amiga. I'm not entirely sure. I haven't used MorphOS yet. I can say, by the way, that in August I'll be getting a Fika machine to loan from someone from the UK. Thank you already. I was going to loan me his machine so I can test MorphOS as well. But there is actually competition in the Amiga world. It's not just the Amiga OS. There's MorphOS and there's ADOS as well. So the Amiga people have the Amiga OS people have the entire Amiga scene for themselves, so that they can make a new operating system or make an improved version, and that all the Amiga users will be more or less forced to use it because that's the only Amiga out there. But there's also MorphOS and ADOS, which are competing with each other for users and everything. So it's not as simple as it seems, basically.
Personally, I find myself on the side of actually defending their odd and backwards and crotchety ways. As a user of Geos for a good number of years, which is an equally crotchety and weird operating system, I feel that the what they're facing, they're never going to be mainstream. It's never going to return to the glory days. No. And so you have this community which is set in their love of their operating system and the way it does things. And the thing is you can either support those kinds of users or try to move in with new users. But the thing is that a lot of those users are going to be using a modern operating system anyway. It's only going to be the extreme diehards that will use only an Amiga or nothing else, maybe someone like Eric Schwartz. I think trying to become a modern operating system as much as the pressure is on, I don't think that's actually always the solution. I think an operating system is perfectly fine to stick to an ever diminishing community as long as it's as long as they're all getting their enjoyment out of it. Operating systems, I think, can die, and in some cases should die, and they should die because they because the community eventually died out, rather than dying by trying to be something they weren't and everybody left.
This discussion keeps reminding me, though, of the entire mainframe environment, because it's really an interesting example that parallels this in some ways. I mean, ZOS, also known as OS390, OS370, OS360, for everyone that
Yes.
might even possibly have heard of this stuff, has custom hardware, just like the Amiga OS. Has a smaller set of incredibly dedicated users, but beyond that, you have a complete difference because you have the Amiga users, which are a desktop-targeted solution. Then you have the big iron, you have the mainframe users, and having a small list of people who you can be perfectly happy with them being crotchety about changing their operating system. Yes, ISPF is a silly name, but who cares? It works, and it's worked for years. Why should we change it? It works for the mainframe because it has one thing that really drives it in terms of the market. It has power, it has security, and it also has power savings, which is becoming a new interesting factor in data center management today. Now, the Amiga, unfortunately, you can't quite make that same leap because it just doesn't work. It's a different market.
Yeah, that it's complicated. They're stuck in a difficult situation. But in fact, we can look at the market and we can see that there are there's three of them in total, and probably a lot more as well. You've got RISC OS, who is in a very similar situation as well, where you've got an official company doing something. You've also got an open source company doing the same operating system with RUL, and you've got proprietary hardware, and then you've got ARUS and the Amiga, and then you've got BIOS and Haiku. These are all three different operating systems, all landing themselves in a similar kind of position. One thing I wanted to bring up, though, was that with these operating systems, there is one thing that is important about all of these operating systems that I think is why they're in the situation they are, and that is the hardware. These operating systems were always intrinsic to their hardware at the time. And,
except BIOS. BIOS ran on Intel without any problems.
That's true, but it also, remember that it was originally came out on that custom PPC chip, Hobgoblin, or whatever it was called.
No, it's basically the development's kind of like this. Originally, it was supposed to go on the Hobbit processor by AT&T, but AT&T discontinued the Hobbit processor before it ever really got into the market. So then they switched to PowerPC, and they made
Yes.
the B-Box, and then the B-Box kind of died out, and they ported the entire thing over to Apple's, the Macintosh machines. But Apple wasn't very forthcoming with hardware specifications. What else is new? And then, then they, in a final ditch effort, they ported the whole thing to the Intel architecture, and then they failed to be bought up by Apple and died out. So, but later on, in the last few years of the BOS, it wasn't really tied to hardware in that sense.
Mm.
So,
but it started out in that way. It was a project that was
yeah,
designed to
true.
Work. The operating system was supposed to be a natural part of how the of a symbiotic relationship with the hardware because of the whole multiprocessor thing and the efficiency of it. And the same with RISC OS having its own very custom hardware on ARM. And what's the other one? And the Amigas and stuff. And in each of these cases, the hardware was better. The hardware was better than the IBM standard platform out there at the time. The Amiga could do things 15 years ahead of its time. Its graphics capabilities were amazing. The RISC OS machines, again, they were fantastic multimedia computers, being 5-10 years ahead of what Windows was doing. They had the taskbar long before Windows had the taskbar. BIOS had multiprocessor. The whole multi-threaded thing years ahead of everyone else, and this was all down to the hardware that these operating systems ran on. So porting these things onto modern operating systems, I think, loses a lot of spirit of what these operating systems are. If they're just downloadable live CD ISOs, then what are they anymore?
Well, I think the problem with that is that you have to, at some point, you got to make a choice. I mean, what is more important to you? Having your operating system available 10, 15 years from now and having it evolve and modernize? Or do you want to keep on using the same thing and have it die out in a couple of years? That's, you know, basically the choice that you got to make. And I think it would be an absolute shame if this stuff like dies out. I mean, I think especially that there isn't that much left anyway. I mean, looking at Genome/KDE and Mac OS X and Windows, they're all effectively the same. There's nothing exciting about any of them, as far as I'm concerned, at least. So there's not really anything exciting going on. And then having stuff like the Amiga and RISC OS and even BOS Haiku, having that die out, or not necessarily die out, but, you know, becoming even more irrelevant than they are today, I think that would be an absolute shame, because there's just so much to learn from projects like that. And I just don't think it's a good idea to let them die. I'd rather have them modernize and maybe lose their hardcore group and at least having them ready for the future in some way, and having them die out. I don't like the idea of stuff dying out, especially not when it comes to operating systems. It's just, there's too much to learn from them.
Well,
to have
when you
them
think
die
of the
out.
Case of operating systems that have died, I mean, Geos is basically dead. As much as it was one of the, it was probably second best operating system at its time, and that's now completely dead, unfortunately. And there's a lot to learn from it, certainly, but I wouldn't want to run Geos Commodore 64 version on my modern computer, nor as much as I would want to run the Geos PC version on my modern computer, because it's just too far behind, it's too impractical, and I could never use it for solid work.
Exactly,
with these operating systems.
Exactly, because it didn't get the chance, at least, to
exactly, but trying to resurrect something like that wouldn't really be any. You would never
no.
be able to get it mainstream enough to matter. You would better port Firefox for it, etc. It would be such an uphill struggle. I think there's better things that can be done with these operating systems. They should, in their microcosm, be allowed to die as far as their hardware is concerned. But the ideas from the operating system is really what we should be taking forward rather than the operating itself. A lot of the UI, etc., can be adopted elsewhere if only the designers are willing to take it.
True.
An interesting point that I keep thinking of is really the PC-based hardware, is that actually becoming more irrelevant? Because if you look at use patterns going forward, you see a lot more people with very powerful video game console systems that can serve as much as a media hub for a household as any PC, arguably better in some cases. In a lot of the primary delivery outlets for media and for data access are no longer PCs, but are coming increasingly through handheld devices.
Yeah, go on.
So is it that really the PC hardware is actually reached kind of an upper bound, and we're just denying the irrelevant as the rest is slowly coming up to swallow it and take over, and we just won't notice the change in our own use pattern?
Basically, we're talking about the future now. I think the future is going to be that computers aren't going to be special anymore. I mean, there's not like, you're not going to care about having some sort of magic box in your room and that's your computer. It's more going to be something that's like, I hate that term, but something that's much more ubiquitous. I can't even spell that word, but
ubiquitous.
Yeah, whatever.
Ubiquitous.
It's everywhere. That's basically the word. But it's they're becoming more. But I think I got a better word. They're becoming more transparent. It doesn't really matter anymore.
Yes.
The computer itself doesn't really matter. It's stuff just got to work. And whether you're using like an God forbid an iPhone or like something like a game console, in the end, they're all going to work together in a way that, in basically the same way that telephones technically all work together, and in the same way that electricity works together, except for different plugs and everything, of course. But electricity is electricity, and whether you're in Germany or in the Netherlands or in Belgium or whatever, you can get a little converter just to change the plug, and you can plug in whatever you want. And computers are probably going into the same direction. We don't want it right. We don't see it right now because we've still got these companies like Apple and Microsoft still clinging on to the idea that a computer is some sort of, you know, thing with boundaries, and it's a box, and that's what you use, and then you go away and you can't use it anymore. I mean, that's something that, at least I think, is going to go away. And at that point, stuff like Amiga and BOS, what we were originally talking about, are going to be even more irrelevant than they already are today. So that's pretty much true, I think. And you can see,
yes.
You can definitely see that
Which
in game
of course.
Consoles now. I mean, a friend of mine, the only one I actually know here who actually has a PS3, PlayStation 3, he used it exactly for all the multimedia thing stuff, so for, you know, like listening to music and watching videos, DVDs, it's all done through the PS3 and not some computer or DVD player, so in that sense it's definitely going that way. Yeah.
Okay, well, that said, that also brings up another good thing, is that obviously these operating systems were great in their day, but that only means that now we've got more diversity now of operating systems. It means that new operating systems can come forward to be those great things of their day. The Amiga was the norm in the day. RISC OS was the norm in the day. Geos was the norm in the day. It wasn't this thing that was so special, as powerful and as great as they are. It's what you sat down to do some work in front of. And now we've got more diversity than we've ever had before. Things like the ARM netbooks, etc., bringing up, and we've got a better chance for Linux. We've got Google's OS. We've got Microsoft trying to push Windows XP embedded or Windows CE. We've got this diversity on the desktop and laptop platform that we've never had before, and I think that gives great opportunity for new operating systems to come forward if they've got the right formula. So maybe not BIOS itself, but a lot of the design ideas of BIOS could be pushed forward in Linux.
Not in Linux. BIOS has absolutely nothing to do with Linux. That's
no, I mean, I'm more thinking of just the UI than rather than the kernels, of, as it were.
Okay, well, again, I wanted to say something really brilliant, but I forgot. That happens every now and then on the podcast. So if someone else could pick up so that I can hide in a corner, that would be nice. Well, maybe that would kind of signal the end of the whole talking about the Amiga. I don't know if anyone has anything to add right here. I mean,
well,
I could talk about maybe about the response from Acube itself, the company that actually sent me.
Yes, you wanted to highlight that.
Yeah, it's they were really happy with the whole thing, and they were, and I kind of like that. Usually companies are really happy with reviews, even if they're have some negative bits in it, because that's stuff that they can improve. I know of only one company that doesn't like negative reviews, but I won't mention them this time. So they were happy, and they noted some of the things that I mentioned that's really good, and they'll try to improve it and everything. And I can keep the machine for a couple of weeks longer, so I can try and get Linux running on it and see how well that works, and write a short article, not as long as the Amiga one, and about that one, to see if there's any merit in running Linux on it, so that maybe the machine would get a little bit more validity among other people who don't want to buy it just for the Amiga operating system, but who would think about buying something like that, if it can do a boot with Linux, or maybe FreeBSD or something like that. So that's interesting.
That was one thing I was going to say. Well, we could move on to the next subject, because I think we are heading that direction anyway. What I was going to say was simply that in another 25 years' time, are we going to have, you know, is Amiga and BIOS and RISC OS even going to be around and relevant anymore? Or are people going to then be clinging on to the operating systems we have now? What if Windows dies out? What if Mac OS dies out? What if this Google OS gets so far and then dies out? And you've got a community in 25 years' time which are hardcore Google OS users, despite it never being updated anymore, and it's completely irrelevant, and technology has moved on so far, and things like that. It's good to have these things from the past, but it's, you know, what goes around in circles, doesn't it, ultimately?
Well, I think operating systems in and of itself, just like the computer, you won't notice the operating system. You won't have these specialized devices, what a computer basically is, where you do all your computing work. It's going to be much more, you know, all around, and you're going to see the computer is going to be in your TV, basically, so. And you won't really care about the whole operating system, just as most people won't care about the operating system on their phone either. It's just there, and it's
more about the interface, isn't it?
Yeah, in the end, yeah. I think, you know, you could use any interface you want on any operating system you want right now, technically, if you had the skills. It's not really that relevant anymore. So even though, you know, back in the day, when I was, you know, still only a couple of years old, you had a lot of different platforms and a lot of different operating systems around, and everything was incompatible with one another. And even though today we're still complaining about stuff being incompatible and being close specifications and everything, I think the computers today are a lot more talkative to one another than they were 20, 30 years ago. I mean, I'm only 24, so it's a little bit difficult for me to really talk from experience, but from what I read about it, computers really were islands back then, and not just because networking wasn't very prevalent, but in general they were islands. Your platform didn't talk to another platform that much. And right now, I mean, if you can just, I mean, I have a mixed network here of Linux machines, of Macintosh machines, of Windows, and everything, and it would all just run among one another. And I almost actually got the Amiga into my network, but I couldn't get somebody running properly. So you can basically have everything connect to one another, and in the end, it doesn't really matter if you're using Linux or Windows or Mac OS X, because they can all talk to each other anyway, and that's only going to get broader, you know. And the more that progresses, the less the operating system will actually matter, and the less companies like Microsoft and Apple will matter, because it's just the whole idea of a separate operating system will probably vanish anyway. At least that's what I think.
This problem actually becomes a lot more magnified in the enterprise world, because there you actually have the data silos. That's what the term that they call it, data silos, is actually a lot more pronounced, because they have a lot more data to work with. And because of that, integration and communication across different platforms becomes that much more expensive and that much more difficult to implement. And there's still a lot of integration projects going on today just to put this system, this mainframe, to talk with these desktops or this AIX WAS cluster or whatever it is. And it's still going on today. It's just magnified because of how much more stuff they have to deal with.
OS News asks, which features are missing from your OS? Tom's interested in what we think is missing from the operating system we use most often that could be added to it to get rid of our niggles from it, to make it an ideal operating system.
I have two off the top of my head.
Can you start, because we've obviously documented ours already on the website, so if you let us know yours and we can start the discussion from there.
Well, for the moment, my preferred operating system is Linux. I'm running Kubuntu 9.10, I believe. What I would really like to see in the overall Linux stack is to get rid of user space X windows. I want that in the kernel, so users do not have to see all of the system details loading up in frame buffer when I boot the system. Every other operating system does this. There has been motive within the XOR community to do this, but it hasn't been done yet. And it's because it requires more integration between the Linux kernel and the underlying windowing system. And that requires a collaboration that hasn't quite been there until just recently. And you see this in a lot of other projects that base themselves off of a Unix stack, the Mac OS being one of them, that show this tight integration between expecting a graphic-rich environment for users to run in, running on top of a kernel. It's not this separate added thing that we have in the Linux world, where conceivably you never have to have that. So that's gripe number one.
Mm-hmm. And that would only, if I may chime in for a second, that would also massively reduce the complexity of a system, and therefore, you know, if you reduce complexity, you technically make a system more dependable, because the less stuff that can go wrong, the less will actually go wrong, right? So it's not just making it more friendly for a user, but also making it more stable and less error prone, because the less layers you have and the less stuff you have talking to each other, the more smoothly everything will run and the less problems you will face with maybe bug fixes or other patches or whatever, because if there's less layers to deal with and less code to deal with.
But this might make the development effort a lot more complex, because now you have to have the kernel team talking with the GUI team in order to make sure that it runs, you know, the drivers correctly, and what's the driver standard, and how are we going to do the DRI underneath the covers and all of this other stuff.
Yeah. Basically.
Yes. And as we know, the whole driver issue is a minefield with Linux, with the kernel not wanting to well, on one hand accepting binary Javas, but on the other hand not wanting them either.
Yeah, well, I thought I was going to say something. Yeah, well, that's obviously a problem, because they want them, but they don't want them. It's basically kind of a complicated idea. I'm not entirely versed in that whole thing. I just use Linux. I don't understand it. So that's, yeah.
I keep wondering if it's more of a developer mentality, because in my experience, it tends to be that people who work on the, quote, back end, like the kernel, don't like working on the front end, i.e. the interface, because it requires two very different styles of programming, different styles of thinking about how to design things, and the two don't mix well together. So just by human nature, one group decides, I'm only going to do this, and this other group says, well, I'm only going to do this. And there's only a few people that bridge the gap between.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I meant with the whole layers thing. So basically, you've got independent groups doing. There's already a lot of coordination within the Linux world, much more than like 10 or 15 years ago. But they're still, you know, it's still separate groups, and they have their own features. And there's no way for one group to basically, between quotes, force the other to implement something, you know, to help each other and make things better.
Right.
And if you had the ability to integrate that more, that would probably benefit the entire environment. But then again, you're basically going to end up with a similar situation that we just discussed with the whole Amiga thing. There are a lot of, let's just call them Unix people who value the way that a Unix / Linux system is built now, you know, with separate things, separate islands that talk to each other, and they really value that system and the way it works. And changing that, again, will meet with a lot of resistance, similar to the resistance that you meet in the Amiga world when you ask for features like auto update or automatic snapshotting and that sort of thing. So it's kind of a similar situation, I think, at least.
But that's more of a user experience question, isn't it? I mean, if I'm running a Linux system that doesn't have X on it, and I'm just typing on a frame buffer or SSHing into the system, would that really make any difference to me if I'm going to not have X on there, or there's just this component which, for all intents and purposes, looks like a normal frame buffer terminal to me when I log into the system physically, but it actually goes through the entire graphical process. I just still get a normal terminal prompt in the end.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, then you lose a little bit of flexibility with that, and with Linux, it's trying to be all things to all people, so you've got the flexibility of being able to SSH into things and not and run a remote X terminal, where you can't really do that with Mac OS X. You can, because it's got X11, but not all apps will run. You can't, you know, getting a remote X terminal on Mac OS X is not easy, and the fact that it doesn't boot up headless, so you lose something there, and you'd have to kind of fork your DMs or something. That's a difficult one. I mean, I don't have enough experience about Linux really to know, but what I pick up, how I see it, is because I am a designer, but I'm also a programmer, but I'm far more interested in the design side of things. I only learned programming just so I could implement what things I was thinking of. It shouldn't actually have to be a situation where you need someone who can design and program to go and solve your problems, because in a professional world, in what Apple have to do with Mac OS X is that you have, it is the programmer's job to implement the designer's design. The designer comes up with something and the program has to implement it. They don't get a say on whether they like it or not. They have to then implement what the designer has come up with, because the designer knows better what it's going to look like, and he leaves it up to the programmer to choose the implementation details, but he expects it to look like what he designed it to look like at the end. And there's that sturgeon divide there, because it's down to, it's a commercial work, it's your job, you've got to do it. But in the open source community, you can pick and choose what jobs you like, and people will pick either the back end or they'll pick the front end, but they're not doing this the real grind stuff, which is having to implement things you don't like implementing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's open source tends to be happy for the developers to code things. I know from my admittedly very limited experience in working on a few open source projects here and there that unfortunately never went anywhere, or fortunately, depending on who you ask. And working on the code was actually the fun part. But if I had to draw up the specification to do, it's going to be like this, but that makes the code a lot more difficult and kludgy in order to make my deadline, then it wouldn't have been as fun to write, and therefore I would have had less motivation to actually work on it that way. And the problem is that you kind of need that to create a really polished product. And what we do have is still quite amazing given the kind of development style we've had going for it. But still, there's so much more that could be done.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, again, the Linux world has made so much progress from the first time that I used it back in like 8, 9 years ago. I mean, the improvements that they've made are, you know, absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, if you... I kind of compare it to the difference between macOS 10.0 and and macOS 10.6 now, right? Yeah, macOS 10.6. And if you compare that to a Linux distribution from that day and from now, I mean, the difference are just as clear cut, basically. I mean, macOS 10.0 was a completely useless piece of nothing, and macOS 10.6 is a really good operating system, and I think the difference in the Linux world is kind of similar. I mean, if you look back upon a distribution from then, it's not really that useful anymore. And if you look at what you have now, it's a complete and useful operating system. If you, for instance, look at Ubuntu or maybe OpenSUSE or something, so the progress that they've made is absolutely excellent. But there's still a lot of work to do. But that, you know, that doesn't just go for the Linux world. Just that the Linux world has a different set of issues that it needs to, a different set of limitations basically that it needs to work with, namely the fact that it's open source, which is both a strength as well as a weakness. But the same goes for closed source development. It's both a strength, mm-hmm. in which you can really focus on something, but it's obviously also a weakness because it, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work out very well.
So yeah, you might write something that your users don't want at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the Skype for interface.
Yeah, that's Skype interface that just for our audience, when we're trying to set up the three-way podcast here, I really found out just how completely insane the Skype interface really is, with 10 million buttons and things that don't work, and advanced buttons that don't really bring up any advanced features and whatever. but basically, to draw the whole discussion back to the article, so
what was Tess's second point?
Yeah,
yes,
second gripe actually is directly related to what I just said. Linux needs a proper voice over IP client. Now, it doesn't have to be Skype. Even if anyone who works at Skype is listening, please, please give us a library or an API or something so that we can code something that will work consistently on our OS. If you can't do it yourself, let us do it for you. Otherwise, we'll make something else.
so what's the problem then with Skype on Linux? I've never used Skype anyway until a couple of weeks ago. But the problem with Skype on Linux then?
Well, the first problem is that you have to run into the audio stack on Linux. Now, if you're using a distribution which is tailored for the desktop, like the Ubuntu series, you actually do get a pretty solid experience there. But the thing is that the Skype client for Linux is way back in the 1.3 days still, and it doesn't interact with the newer versions that are running on XP and Vista and on the Mac and all of these other versions that are far ahead protocol-wise compared to the Linux version. So it's like pulling teeth to get a high-quality call out of the Linux Skype client. And that's only half the equation. The other problem is webcams. Skype on Linux and webcams is pain. It is, as you said in your last podcast, a bag of hurt. You have to go through the Linux for the video for Linux stack. You have to make sure that your camera is supported. You have to make sure that the kernel modules are up to date. You often have to manually install them because the web camera standards aren't really there yet. And it's just painful to get it to work. I've had conversations on Skype on Linux with a webcam. I would have to unplug the web camera, put it in a literal different USB port to get the camera to work again. Or worse comes to worse, kill -9 the Skype process and start the whole thing over again. I think once I even had to control alt backspace and kill X just to get the thing to work. It was It's painful.
And to make matters worse, you can't control Alt Backspace anymore. Ha!
Oh,
Because
you can
the.
enable that.
Yeah,
You
but
can
the.
actually enable it, but it's disabled by default in 9, which
Yeah.
is annoying. I didn't like that very much.
Neither did I. I was like, I had a crash somewhere and I was pressing Control Alt Backspace and I thought, why isn't this working? Why isn't this. I mean, the caps lock key still works. Why isn't Control Alt Backspace working? And then I found out that they disabled that. So that's. So to bring it back, that's the second point. Is there also a third point that you want to bring up regarding this discussion?
Actually, no, I just
Of
said two
this
points.
article, sorry.
Yeah, about the article. Yeah, exactly.
Well, of this article, a lot of the comments, the Linux sound stack was brought up time and time and time again. Almost every mention of Linux mentioned the sound, because it is just a severe problem. And I think we all think that really the sound stack should be just rethought, the whole thing dumped and restarted, or at least just to go back to one layer, because that's what it should be in the first place, is just having one layer.
Well, if I can be the devil's advocate a little bit here. Linux audio developers, take the audio stack in Vista and Windows 7 apart, because that is what a good audio stack is supposed to do. It is some pretty advanced stuff. I mean, you can plug stuff in and it will automatically work, and you don't have to worry about restarts. You can control, you can fine-grained control over every audio stream. That is basically what you want. I mean, I'm not entirely sure if macOS X has something similar, because at least not on the UI side.
Yes, that's pretty true. It's got a very good audio stack, certainly because Mac OS X is very favored for doing any kind of industrial audio work. But no, the UI just isn't there. You can't do per application volume control. I'm sure they could plug it in. Maybe another version of the operating system will bring that. But right now, no, doesn't no such UI exists.
That's basically
I
what
thought
I,
there was a command line app
yeah,
for
go on.
that. I thought there was a command line app for that, actually, that allowed you to toggle the volume control over the terminal, basically.
Need to say so. I vaguely recall something similar, reading it in some of the comments about Windows 7's audio stack. We had an article way back then
Yeah, yeah,
about
yeah, yeah.
somewhere in there.
Gosh, yeah, that's some time ago.
Yeah, I really I have this weird thing where I remember a lot of the at least the first like the first 10 to 15 comments on each article. I have this weird sense where I vaguely recall each and every one of them. I think that's basically where I heard that as well, that you can manipulate the audio stack in macOS X via the command line, which of course is no way to manipulate an audio stack, but at least it's something, so and Windows really is ahead on that one, at least on the user interface side. I don't know anything about the technical performance of the stack, and it's not don't ask me, but at least when it comes to ease of use, I mean the audio stack in Windows and the interface are really really good. It's really really handy to be able to specifically lower applications that are a little bit louder and just give them a little lower volume than others, and that's the kind of thing that the Linux will see. We'll just look at how it's implemented in Windows and then maybe even in Mac OS X how that's done. Implement and basically give me pretty much that, because that works. It's easy to use. It doesn't crash. It always does its job, and it will restart. If it does crash, it will restart just like the graphical server between quotation marks in Windows. That's kind of what you want here, I'd say. And I think the whole it used to be called Polyp Audio. What's it called now? Pulse Audio. That's basically been pretty much a disaster, as far as I can understand it, in that it didn't work and it crashed, and people were angry and switched back to ALSA and the OSS Mixer. And so yeah, I think if you look at features that Linux users want, it's probably audio. You're right about that one.
And there is an excellent post on the Engineering Windows 7 blog about use patterns and system interrupts related to media such as video
Yes.
and audio streams. And that was really incredibly enlightening for the kind of requirements you're really asked to do for that kind of a stack. And it was really quite mind-blowing to me just how much they looked into to what their users are doing, what their experiences are, what compromises they have to make with the hardware they had to work with, and also all the legacy support they have to deal with. And there's a lot to learn from that article, in my
Yeah, I
opinion.
think Microsoft is really, as weird as it may sound, with their information that they've been putting out via the Engineering Windows 7 blog, by using all the, what's it called, the reporting.
Customer experience,
Yeah, I mean,
customer thingy
yeah,
program.
that's very valuable data that they've basically been putting out there for everyone to use. I mean, and I think developer of other operating systems would be stupid not to actually use the information that they've put here and use that to improve their experience. Especially the whole UI things that they put out there are really interesting. Of course, the glitching thing. I'm looking at the article right now. It was the 17th of July of June. Sorry, that we published that one. Of course, that's really related specifically to Windows, but it still gives some interesting information that could be used there. But you are right, Tess, and it was a really interesting article. About not improving audio glitching, about reducing audio glitching in Windows. That was pretty interesting.
Let's think. Well, Tom, do you want to cover your things you wanted to say add to your operating system?
Yeah, sure. Let me get the article back because, it's, like I said, I was searching for the. There we go. Which features are missing? there we are. I probably said a few things about BOS, didn't I? Yeah. I'm using Windows 7 as my main operating system these days. I didn't used to use Windows as my main operating system, but 7 kind of changed my mind last Christmas. And no, don't start about WAM, please. What did I say? Yeah, most of my features are about window management. Window management always used to be a bit of a problem in Windows, that it was very limited and it didn't really work in the way I wanted it to work. They've made a lot of improvements in 7, not just with the taskbar, but also the whole Windows Snap feature, especially if I'm working on my thesis right now, and just having the ability to instantly have two windows side by side just by dragging them to the sides and be able to compare your stuff. It's really handy when you're reading a lot of scientific articles and you want to use that material in your own thesis. It's really, really handy. And of course, you know, the peaking and all that stuff, it's really been an improvement. But there's still so much about window management in Windows that I don't like. And the first thing is that I just want a working, smooth version of Exposé from macOS 10 on Windows. I mean, I've used basically all of the... I've tried all of the third-party utilities that bring Exposé-like functionality to Windows, but they all suck and they're not smooth and they take up way too many system resources. Technically, it should be easy to implement it. I just don't understand why Microsoft just doesn't suck it up, basically, and implement Exposé. I mean, even though it originated from Apple, it's an excellent feature. Just implement it all right and remove that stupid Flip 3D thing, which is completely, utterly useless. I've never used it anywhere because it's completely useless. If they would have integrated Exposé, I would have been very, very welcome because the third-party people aren't doing that very well right now. So that's one of the things that I really, really want. Other things that would be really welcome, but those are really specifically related to me being coming from a BOS world, and they're not really that useful for other people. And one of them is double-clicking on the title bar to minimize a window. You can do that. That's default behavior in BOS, and you can set that as an option these days in macOS 10 because of all the B engineers that are now working at Apple. Because double-clicking to maximize, it never made no sense to me. Because first, I don't maximize windows anyway. If you have a large display, it makes no sense. Double-clicking on a title bar, why should that maximize? Of course, you can ask the same question, why would it minimize? But for some reason, it's just a natural gesture, a natural result of the double-click gesture to me. But that might just be me, I don't know. And what I kind of lack is the ability to send a window to back with your mouse. Someone posted a comment that you can do it with a keyboard shortcut. I'm not entirely sure what you're...
Alt-Escape. But it doesn't actually put the window to the back. All Alt-Escape does is the same as Alt-Tab, but it goes through all windows it doesn't tie them to specific programs. So you can use Alt-Escape and you can actually Alt-Tab through dialog boxes and things that don't normally appear on the Alt-Tab. Well, I generally use Alt-Escape all the time.
I'm trying it right now and I can only switch between my main Chrome window and the main Skype window. I can't even switch to Audacity or something, so it's not really that useful. But basically, what's handy about it is you have if dialogues open up, or you have a number of dialogues waiting that you need to work with, or you have a smaller window that's behind your main window, and the main window these days, at least for me, is either the browser or the emailer, and they're large, so they can easily cover an application, and then having to go actually to the to the taskbar and switch to it is just problematic. And on macOS 10, you have Exposé, right? So you can use Exposé.
You also got like Hide as well. You can just Command H and hide it, or Alt Tab and use H to hide
exactly.
As well. I find that quite useful.
But I tend to do a lot of stuff with the mouse and not with the keyboard. So I want to have the ability to send a window to back with the mouse, and I use that on BOS all the time. And it's such a handy little feature to have if you have a lot of applications open with maybe dialogues and stuff like that. Just being able to click on your main window and have it sent back, it's really, 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 really handy. And the third big one for me, but that's more of a design issue, I think, with Windows, is that when you... this could be a bit vague if I don't explain it properly enough. If you have a number of windows open and you click in Windows on an inactive window, it will actually, the window that you're clicking on will register that click. So if you happen to click on a button, even though the window is inactive, your click will get processed. And I find that completely idiotic and problematic, especially if you have an application with lots of buttons or maybe even a dialogue where clicking a certain button can really ruin your outcome. I just want to be able to click in a window and not have it register set click. I mean, BOS does it that way, Mac OS X does it that way, luckily. You can actually set that behavior in KDE. I'm not entirely sure about Gnome, actually. I believe they actually register that click as well. That's really a feature that I would want. And even though I put it in the last, as my last favorite feature, I would probably technically want it on the top, because I think that's actually a usability issue, a usability fail, basically. If you click on an inactive window, the name says it, the window is inactive, so it shouldn't work, right? That's what an inactive window is supposed to be, so I'm not entirely... that's really my most hated thing in Windows, where I am doing a lot of multitasking, like with my thesis, for instance, where I'm having 10 million windows open, and then suddenly I accidentally click somewhere and something happens, and I have no idea what is happening because I wasn't actually paying attention, because I'm just used to the fact that if I click a window, nothing happens. That's what I want. You click to activate a window, and then you start using it. That's kind of how I see the whole thing. Boom. Now it's your turn, Croc.
Okay. Let's have a look. Okay, I was kind of all over the place with mine, but Mac OS X I use all the time, and I love it. It works. It's not the best operating system ever, or it's got its flaws, etc., but it's the one I have to deal with the least amount of problems with. And what I was asking for is a better Time Machine, basically. Time Machine is great, the fact that I don't have to think about it, but actually trying to get a file back is a bit of a chore. It's slow. It's a single process way of doing anything, and the UI is just outright weird. The fact that you have to click a dock icon, you have to actually click on an application or a task menu bar item to bring up a Time Machine for a different app that's got the focus. That's just weird in anybody's book. I mean, some operating systems have done some weird things, like we were talking about Amiga OS. This takes the biscuit for detached UI.
If I interrupt you for a second there, the big problem that I have with the Time Machine is that it's technically completely what I would call single tasking. So you can only work with one specific window, and you can't move stuff around. What I would like to see, if you with a feature like Time Machine, and that's basically what OpenSolaris is doing, is that it's tied to the directory you're currently looking at, and I think that makes a lot more sense than having this weird flashy user interface with stars and all that stuff. I mean, I think it's not just completely over the top, but it completely ruins the functionality, because you can't have multiple windows open. What I would like is that you could travel back in time in a specific directory, and then just being able to drag and drop into another directory if you want to. That you shouldn't be tied to a single folder, which is what happens on a Mac right now. And I think it's really counterproductive. And even though I've had Macs for a very long time, I've never used Time Machine because it's a chore. Like you said, you have to do so much stuff to get your file back. Of course, it's still better than the completely hidden feature in previous versions, which is I have no idea why Microsoft didn't capitalize on that one, because it's actually much more advanced than Time Machine. But it's just so weird that a company like Apple would make you go through 10 million steps just to get your stupid file back, instead of just making it much more tied to a window, instead of having it tied to your entire computer, which is basically what happens now.
So this is the feature in Solaris 2009. It's a time slider, so they're using ZFS snapshots, which is a brilliant idea, you know, straight away, so that you can then just slide back whatever folder you're looking at in a particular browser window back to whatever time, and then easily compare window to window, manage your windows, etc. I think Apple are probably going to be forced to go that way anyway. I it's only a UI issue. If they just spend enough time on the UI, they'll be able to solve that. The problem with the way Time Machine works, the problem is because it's a single process and it forces you into this blinkered view of things, they have to keep cropping everything. They have to crop the UI out. You can't some actions you can't do, and certain aspects of the side pane in Finder don't work, and certain when you right click on files you've got less options, or certain some of them don't work. So they're having to keep cropping out this UI, which should normally work anyway, and so they're only making more work for themselves. I think that's something I hope that they will rethink in 10.7 whenever they get to it. But moving on, I've used RiskOS before. I used it when I was at school, and it's a wonderful operating system. It's just as quirky as Amiga OS is, so it's by no means a relevant or a good operating system to start out with in this day and age. But it was very innovative at the time. It obviously had a UI way back when that was a new thing. It had the task, the taskbar, long before Windows had that feature. But it also did a number of things very uniquely. It had a three-button mouse with the ability to interact with Windows without actually bringing them to the forefront, a bit like you can do in Amiga OS, but this was done via a right-click menu. The right-click button. The other thing it did, interestingly, was that there were all menus were context menus. There was no distinction between a main menu for an application and a context menu on a right-click. Everything was a context menu. So a context menu, right-clicking on the actual application would bring you the applications menu, but if you right-clicked on some text, you would get the text, etc., and things like that. And RiskOS's these context menus took things a little further than what we normally got as far as menus on other operating systems. The menu items can actually be just about anything. They can even put entire dialog boxes in sub-menu items. So you can choose, you can have text input fields, you can have up-downs widgets, you can have entire entry forms on a sub-menu. So you choose something like, you click on a shape and you choose the rotate menu and say how much, and it will give you a slider, so you can choose how much all within the context menu.
Awesome.
And another good thing of how it did this is where it did something very beautiful and very elegant, I think, at least if it was shown and done in a modern context in Mac OS X, is that when you wanted to save a file, it didn't bring up a file picker to say, where would you like to save this file? It actually gave you a proxy icon of your file that you could name, and then you drag the file to where in the operating system you wanted it to exist. And that's how you saved things. So instead of duplicating this, instead of duplicating the filing system by having a file picker and breaking the whole spatial nature of it, because RiskOS is a spatial file system, you would drag the file that you're working on to where you want it to be. And I think Mac OS X would massively benefit from that, because it's got the window management to be able to easily get from A to B. Because it's got a half-decent file browser, the whole having a file browser when you save something just seems inadequate when you've got a perfectly good, more capable system already attached to the operating system. So that's something I would really like to see in Mac OS X. Doubt it will ever happen, unfortunately.
Well, I think it's, when I read that, I didn't actually know that. I mean, I was you know, like 3 centimeters short of cheering, because I think it's really, really awesome. And it's a really good idea, especially for a mouse-driven interface, to be able to just do this, and instead don't get some weird file save dialog, which especially on Windows there are 10 million variants of. So it's only complicates things. Just being able to get like this proxy icon, like I had to actually look up what a proxy icon was, but I found out.
Let me send you a screenshot so you can see here. Have you clicked that?
Oh,
and you'll get the idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I kind of got the whole idea that that's what's going to happen. I think that's absolutely awesome, just to be able to drag it to a window that you've got already open anyway, and just drag it out there and have it saved. That's completely into the whole...
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's what I thought. It's completely in the whole... completely tied to the whole idea of using a mouse. I think it's absolutely brilliant of not having to deal with these ridiculously complicated, usually, file save dialogues, which have to incorporate so many things. Like you said, you got to have a directory tree, you got to have... somewhere to enter the file name. You gotta have a picker for which format you wanted to save in. I think it's very, very complicated, and this is just really, really, oh yeah, it's the menus as special things thing. Yeah, I think it's really elegant, and I would totally love to see that on Windows and Mac OS and everywhere else. So yeah, completely agree.
Yeah, it was a very creative operating system. Obviously, it's old, so how it functions, using the operating system now is by and large very clunky. But as I was, I think I was highlighting in perhaps, I think it was last podcast's thread or the actual one we're discussing, is that these operating systems, had they been mainstream and continue to be mainstream, and they were given the time to mature from what they were then to what they could be now, if they were in the same situation as Mac OS X or Windows, then all of that would have been polished out naturally. We would have so much better systems. These are just the initial concept, the prototype, as it were. And that's why I'd love to see these sort of things appear in modern operating systems, because as bad as they look on these old operating systems, they could be something so much better by now. It's the same with the B operating system. HiQ is great, but it's just a re-implementation of a 2001
Yeah,
operating system.
currently.
It's not a 2009 operating
Yeah, but
system currently, anyway.
That's their goal.
That's the goal,
That's the
yes.
goal right
That
now.
is their
And
goal, of
improve
course, I should
upon
say.
the base. Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, but it would have been, BIOS would have been something different had it been continually improved since
Yeah,
2001 to
of course.
what we have now. It wouldn't be HiQ, whereas that's what most people assume.
It would be multi-user. The basis for
Exactly, yeah.
multi-user was
Yeah.
there. It just wasn't used, and it was very limited. So it would be multi-user. It probably had. I would probably even think that it would have 3D acceleration of the interface before the others would have it. I'm pretty sure of that one. It would have a lot of cool stuff, and it would have made much better use of metadata, which is something that you also brought up as.
That's the other main point that I
Yeah.
want to bring up, is the B filing system being able to just using extended attributes, which most, in fact, all operating main file systems have now. NTFS has it, and HFS Plus has it, but the software isn't using it, and so we're not getting the benefits of the creativity that you can do with that. And the BIOS showed that creativity by using extended attributes as a way of avoiding having to use databases for other
Yeah, and
things.
there's an additional problem actually with why we're not using metadata that much is that it isn't persistent across the network. Because
Yeah.
when it comes to networking, we use the lowest common denominator, which is the file allocation table, so it's just FAT. And everything that's even slightly more complicated, everything will get cut down to FAT levels, basically. So you can't have metadata because it's specific to the operating system, and there's no way to
That's a
transfer.
terrible
Yeah,
shame.
there's no way to transfer metadata from NTFS to BFS or to HFS Plus or something. It's not possible right now. So that's a very limiting factor. So, and that's one of the reasons probably why we're still using these crappy databases that are laid on top of the file system, even though the file system is perfectly capable. Of managing that stuff by itself without having to use something like an iTunes database or a Windows Media Player database or whatever. So it's that's definitely something I didn't include it in the article, but definitely that should be a priority for everyone. It would be so lovely if everybody sat down, like the people from Apple and people from Linux quotation marks and people from Microsoft, they would all sit down and have a cup of tea and share some flowers with each other and come up with a way of sharing metadata among one another. That would be so cool, and then the developers could write code for completely built around the concept of metadata, and not having to be afraid of not being able to write multi-platform code or sharing stuff among users. So that would be yeah, that would be really cool. I agree.
Is there anything you wanted to add to us?
Few thoughts occur to me, but they'd probably lead the conversation off in another direction
Well, that
completely.
doesn't
Oh, not
matter.
that that
We'd
matters.
never,
No, honestly.
as if we cared about that before.
No.
Well, I'm wondering if the hierarchical nature of the file system
Ooh.
itself is actually an idea that needs to be
That's a really good
scrapped,
idea.
because a lot of the programs that you see here now, they don't. I mean, if you go to Google Docs, if you go to iTunes, what do you see? Do you see icons? No, you don't see that at all anymore. You see library lists. And to me, that is a lot easier to go and search a library and find something by a few tags and be done with it. And if people find the hierarchical file system idea just inherently complicated, why not do something more like a library-oriented file system, at least presentation? And then you can query for it through standard viewers using metadata to expand those
Oh,
attributes.
I'm really weird on that one because I manage all my files completely manually. I have a very organized file structure, just like my house is completely organized to the last bit. The same goes for my file system, which has basically been organized in the same way for, I don't know, 10, 15 years. I have no idea. So I'm very very manual
same here.
When it comes to organizing my files, and I don't trust databases or whatever. So I'm really into the whole folder thing, and every time someone comes up with an idea of ditching the hierarchical, which is a word I can't pronounce, the hierarchy thing structure that's used by basically every file system, every time I kind of cringe, because the solution, I've never seen a proper working solution to that problem. Basically what people come up with is just slapping a big database on top of the file system, basically what Microsoft's been trying to do ever since, I don't know, since the Cairo days or something. With they later called it WinFS, which basically it's not a new file system; it's just a database on top of NTFS, and then you extract the information from the database and being able to use that. But I don't think that's an ideal solution, because technically you're still using the old idea, the old hierarchical whole structure. So I've never seen someone come up with something that would work better. I mean, I'm totally open to it. I mean, managing file systems is problematic, but it's a very complicated thing to come up with something here that's actually better or easier to implement and easier to use. It is a difficult one.
Well, I've been wanting to write an article about this. This is a real area of interest for myself. But I reckon I can cover most points here in the podcast anyway. Is that yes? This thing's been plaguing me about the hierarchical file system and the database things we've got, and I don't think one can outright replace the other or vice versa. Take for example this. I'm like you, Tom. File everything Windows, and I've learned the way. I've learned doing it this way because the Windows XP search was so slow, and the previous version of Windows before that I never search. I never use search. I only ever used search when I moved to Mac, and then I only use that to open applications. Everything is in a folder where I know where it should be, and I can find it easily by just drilling through folders.
Same here, yeah.
Exactly. And I find that good because that means I can structurally organize things by projects, etc. And a database system can't handle that kind of thing. For example, what Windows is doing with the home group, Windows 7 with home groups, etc., and also what Mac OS X does with its saved searches, etc., I think is completely counterintuitive. Where it just says, here's all the files from yesterday, or here's all the images on your computer, that's totally useless. That's just completely and utterly, you know, doesn't show you anything relevant to any work that you're doing. It doesn't help you to have just all the images dumped in one folder on your computer, regardless of where they are located, because you don't work like that. You work for projects.
I want to interrupt you for a second, because that's not entirely what I believe you're referring to. Libraries, actually, and not home group, because home group is a networking thing. You're probably referring to libraries, but it's not what libraries is for. It's not about dumping everything in the same folder. What libraries allows you to do is have a single entry point for all your files of a certain type. So I have a lot of, like I said in the last podcast, I have a lot of television series stored on my external hard drive. So I have that folder shared, obviously, and then all the libraries on my different computers, all the video libraries, actually point to that thing. So you can have the same entry point for your videos that are stored locally as well as on the network, or on an external source. You have a single entry point. It basically is some sort of umbrella. So I have a videos library that's an umbrella for all the locations where I store videos. I have a pictures library. But if you go to the videos library, it's still stored per location. So I have...
Oh, yes, I'm saying it's still stored in their individual folders,
yeah.
How you've organized it, etc. But it's the whole idea of doing a search and just finding a whole bunch of files of certain type and listing it. I don't find that... This is completely useless. It's not practical to project-based work yet. But saying that, I do use databases, and they work well. iTunes, for example, I don't ever use. Ever since I started using iTunes, I don't ever touch my music folder. I don't go into there. The fact that it exists on my hard disk is I'm not interested in that. iTunes is catered towards how I interact with those sets of files, and the same is with iPhoto, with photos, etc. So there's places where databases do work perfectly fine, and then there's places where they don't, and that's why I think you can't completely outright replace the hierarchical system. However, I think there's ways that you can present it so that it's most practical to the kinds of work that you're doing. And getting back to BIOS, of really we should have been doing this with all the metadata stuff, because that would allow give us the flexibility that we can work in project mode or we can work in browsing mode.
Oh, I mean, the metadata in BOS was so powerful. I mean, the best example ever is using metadata to organize your contacts in your instant messaging application. That was just so insanely handy and cool that you could make your own contact list just by using, and instantly as well, just by using the file system, and being able to manage your music using just the file system, or your images using just the file system, without being forced to use monstrosities of applications. I really dislike applications like iTunes and iPhoto. I mean, there might be good applications in and of itself, but they're so massive, basically, because they're using their own database. They're generally very slow. I mean, if most of them are very, very slow. I mean, I find iTunes completely so unresponsive and so slow to browse, so slow to do whatever it does, that I just hate it from the bottom of my heart. And it's not necessarily because iTunes itself is such a bad application, but the whole idea behind it is bad. And it doesn't just go for iTunes. The same thing applies to managing music via Windows Media Player or most of the others. It's just they're not really tailored
it's,
for my kind of
it's
view.
It's an interface put on top of a bad implementation.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where I think BIOS got things right. If I could create my, if I, this is probably what we should each tackle, is if we could make our perfect operating system based on whatever operating systems are out there, and we could just munge them together and come out with something at the other end, what I would do is I would take RISC OS and I would take BIOS and I would stuff them together, give them 9 years to mature, and you'd have pretty much what I would consider the perfect operating system. Because how I would tackle this idea of having both project-based file hierarchy way of working and a database-based way of working, such as music and photos, how I would handle this is obviously attributes, doing it via attributes, but I would have customized shell spaces. I would have applications that are folders, but the folders are also the data folders at the same time. So you would go to your documents folder and you double click on music, but instead of getting a music folder, you would get a customized music folder that was basically iTunes. And if you double clicked on your pictures folder, you would get iPhoto. And all it would be is just literally a customized shell space attached to a folder of data using extended attributes for the actual database side of things.
Well, what?
Kind of the way that perspectives are used in the Eclipse toolkit to give different ways of working with the IDE cater to each individual style of work. Is this an admin perspective, a Java perspective, a PHP perspective, a database development perspective? And all of those really go back to a file system that is hierarchical, but you never touch it because it's all in the project manager. View.
If I were to make my ideal operating system, it would probably be, well, BOS obviously, but it would, I'm kind of arrogant on this one, but it would implement the whole application management thing that I wrote a couple of, well, probably a year ago now. I've been plugging that one on Windows for a while now.
I'll have to go back and read that actually.
Yeah, so that would probably be a combination. That whole idea came out of BOS anyway, so that's not much of a problem. That would basically be my. And then again, have it mature for 9 years or 8 years, and then you would probably have something that would be my ideal operating system. In that BOS didn't force you, not as much at least as other applications, didn't force you to use these monolithic applications. And the mail thing was exactly the same. Every email was its own little file, and
exactly.
You treated it as a file. I mean, contacts is the same thing.
That's how it happens.
Yeah,
the email would be just a folder, but the folder would be the application at the same time.
Well, and basically what happens in BOS, for instance, for email is that there's a UI for sending an email, and there's a UI for there's a UI for creating / sending an email, there's a UI for reading an email, and they all, they're not really applications per se. It's just if you double click on an email file, it will just open using that specific UI, and they made the first steps. It wasn't pervasive enough, I think, because I think they could have done the same thing with music, for instance, that you didn't have to use some sort of that we'd just be able to go to a directory with music in them and then just press. Or you could make obviously a query using a query to, for instance, all the music from Fiona Apple, and then just have a play button or something, and it would play straight from the file manager, and it would give you the same features without forcing you to load up a specific application. I just don't like that whole idea of you're really tied to your applications, and if something changes inside that application, or a new version comes out and you don't like it, you're kind of lost for a second there, because you have to, you know, adapt. And I just don't like that whole applications are technically very inflexible. That's basically it. They really limit you in what you can do, and that BOS really made the first step, at least from my perspective. I of course haven't used stuff like RiskOS or whatever as often, but BOS made the first few steps in eliminating technically eliminating the need for these monolithic applications that force you to do things in a certain
that's
way.
That's kind of how it started out in the beginning, but we moved away from that, because if you think of what Xerox had, Xerox Park, the Star operating system, and you also think of Lisa and then the original Mac, they were document-centric operating systems. They didn't have these monolithic apps, or what apps they were not trying to be monolithic. How I've said it on my website is that brands are a barrier to transparency, because we're trying to push brands, and therefore we're trying to push commercial success with having to create these monolithic things. Why is iTunes called iTunes instead of Music? Why is it not just called Music? Because what it is.
Technically, it shouldn't have a name. I mean, the mail application.
No,
the
that's
mail
exactly
application
it.
Between quotation marks again in BOS. It didn't have. It had a name for the process, but it didn't need a name. It was just send an email, basically, and that's kind of. Again, you're right on that one. Why should it, technically it shouldn't need a name? If an application, there are always exceptions, of course. I mean, something like Photoshop or even your browser, for that sense. I mean, there are limitations to that. But in the end, you shouldn't need a name for an application. If you need a name, you're probably doing something wrong, because it's not, especially if you get to the more simple tasks like sending an email or even instant messaging, it shouldn't need a specific application that can actually crash and make things worse. And make things more harder to use, so that shouldn't be necessary there.
Okay.
We have to do a little song and dance before someone picks up the.
Watch the time of week go by.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, basically, no. 120. We said something about our favorite things that we want. What would?
Oh, Tess. Yeah. Sorry. If you want to what would you consider your perfect operating system if you could just make one out of what's out there, or something from scratch?
I'm going to have to get unnecessarily philosophical here and just saying that there really is no perfect operating system. And even if you take both of your ideas, which I rather like a lot of your ideas, and you combine them with something internet-enabled, leveraging semantic web technology to do all the indexing on all of the metadata files, or doing something incredibly nifty like that, it might not necessarily work in all cases. That's the problem, that we keep thinking that an operating system can be a general use case, but we increasingly find that there's a different use pattern from I'm at home and I just need to use the internet, or I'm at work and I need to use 15 different compilers and a VM and Eclipse and all of these other products which cost universe knows how much, and or I'm a mainframe developer and all I need is 3270 in order to get to the mainframe system. They're all different use patterns, and I think that we keep trying to shoehorn so much into the, quote, perfect operating system that it might not necessarily really exist.
That's definitely true, but I was, at least for me, I was kind of thinking from my own perspective here, so I didn't really take other people's needs into account. So I was really looking from my own little world and say, what would be perfect for my world? But obviously, what would be perfect for my world most certainly won't be perfect for other people, because my perfect operating system would always have a Fiona Apple wallpaper, and it would only play Fiona Apple songs and everything. So it wouldn't be perfect for other people. But yeah, so you're obviously right in that, you know, you can't be all, like Croc said a couple of times, but you can't be all things for all people. But I was really talking about myself and my own specific needs.
No, that's a really good point that you brought up, that says, because, take for example the difference between Windows Mobile and the iPhone operating system. How trying to shoehorn a desktop into a mobile phone, having to have a task manager on your phone, and having to open up task manager and kill an app and trying to do slow right clicks on it, and it doesn't work. It's just completely cumbersome and it's crap. And where Apple have come in and designed something that actually suits the hardware and suits the tasks that you're doing, and lo and behold, they've actually made a success of it. And again, as I was saying, but we've had so much diversity. That's true that we're also having more operating systems that are tailored towards their particular tasks and therefore are proving more successful and more useful. And personally, it's like it's an almost a scary thing because we've been so used to this one desktop does it all way of doing things for so many years. And suddenly you've got all these operating systems everywhere, and they can't all do everything, but they're all capable of doing something, and you've got to string it all together.
Well, I think basically what, especially the iPhone, but in a much smaller way, the WebOS as well, is showing that there was this general assumption, and that's still very prevalent among people on OS News, that people are stupid, at least when it comes to computers, that if you give them something different than Windows, that they will cringe and that they won't know how it works and everything. But if you look at the success of the iPhone, if you look at how well the WebOS has been received, and if you, but more, and even to a slightly lesser degree, to how easy people apparently find it to switch to macOS 10, but especially I think the iPhone is the best example. That if you come up with an interface that's completely different, completely new, that it doesn't mean that people won't be able to use it just because it's different. And I think the same would go, just to get back to the desktop, would go for the desktop. There is nothing. There's no law that states that if you come up with something that's radically different than Windows or you know Gnome KDE and Mac OS X, which are technically the same as far as I'm concerned, that it's definitely possible to come up with something that's completely different and completely new and still have it be become a success. And I think the iPhone is definitely an example of that. While the iPhone may not, I don't consider it that revolutionary that some other people consider it. But if you look at the phones before the iPhone. And then the iPhone itself, it's a massive step forward, and it does a lot of things very, very differently, and people have been able to adapt to it like a snap, you know, with a flick of the wrist, it's no problem for anyone. So, except for me, because I can't type on a touchscreen, but for the rest, most people have absolutely no problem with something that is so radically different from phones that they had before. And that kind of proves, as far as I'm concerned at least, it proves to me that people who use computers like Windows are not as averse to change as all these nerds on our websites have been trying to make it out to be. I don't think that's true anymore, and I think the iPhone really shows that, at least.
That made me think of the whole tablet thing, as we all thought that tablets would take off, and we'd all be doing tablet computing, and we'd get rid of the keyboard and so forth, and it hasn't worked out, and I think the reason it hasn't worked out is because the operating system hasn't been there. You can't just take existing operating systems that were designed and programmed, built around one set of interface rules, and then immediately apply it to a new set of hardware that uses different interface and expect everyone to find it nice and easy,
yeah.
Because it isn't. Tablets have got their own set of problems, and the iPhone has come the closest to solving the touchscreen issue, and I think for tablet computing to take off, the same thing will be needed, a new operating system or a whole new UI paradigm that dumps everything that's ever existed before and starts again.
Well, that comes from the premise that you would actually want a tablet computer, because I think there, the tablet computers that we have now, there are two large, and even if you would make like a 12-inch screen or something and turn it into a tablet, I think it's still too large to be comfortable, because you always lose one hand holding the actual thing, and you won't be able to use that hand. But if you got an iPhone, you can still, even though you're holding it with one hand, you can still use your thumb and on that hand and use it, but you can't do that with a tablet. I think the tablet form factor, more specifically, you won't be able to save the tablet form factor by having better software, because I think, just a little side note here, that the tablet form factor in and of itself is flawed and incapable of fulfilling any need, beyond maybe where I've seen it's like people who are in the field for anything, for taking notes and stuff like that. There it could be useful, but in general usage around the house, I don't really see the usefulness, as a little side note here, for whatever whatever it's worth.
You can really see an excellent example of how the UI clashes if you ever try to run live Android in a VM. If you've ever used the device physically, it feels very natural. You put your finger on it, you start flicking through the activity screens, it's very easy. And then you put it on a desktop with a keyboard and a mouse, and suddenly it's like,
yeah.
What is this? It didn't help either that the first build of Live Android that I got a hold of, the cursor is this 40% transparent little tiny upside down black triangle that you can't see on top of anything else. It's ridiculous. But if it were a tablet, it would still feel very natural for me, even if the interface didn't downscale enough. I mean, you should be able to put a setting in there somewhere that you can downscale the size so that all of the elements size to the kind of resolution and this kind of screen space you have available. And this reminds me actually of the earlier question about what my ideal operating system would be. And I actually would like to suggest something really ridiculously out there. There is an anime called Denu Coil, which one of the story is interrelated to the primary primary computing device, which is actually, it just looks like a pair of glasses. But they don't correct vision, they're actually augmented reality glasses. And giving someone a file, like sharing a file, is simply you have the file in your hand and you hand it to them. Now neither of you have the actual file, but it's a really incredibly nifty concept, the way they did that throughout the entire show. And
awesome.
The story
sounds,
is actually pretty good too.
Like the Borg with that little thing before their eyes. I think it's, yeah, that's, you know, of course that's, you know, way into the future. But that's really something that I found really interesting because there's a Dutch author called Evert Hartmann. Everyone in the Netherlands knows who he is. And he wrote a couple of books about the future, but of course all situated in the Netherlands where half of the country had, you know, gone underwater and all that stuff. And he wrote those books he wrote that specific book actually in I believe in the late 80s or the early 90s, so that's quite a while ago. And he had all these concepts that we're thinking about now. We already had those. For instance, instead of like having a credit card or something, he had a little ring with a little display on it, and you could just tap. You could just tap it to someone else's ring, and then be able to transfer money from to each other. Or you had a sort of phone-like thing that was basically wrapped around your wrist, and you could all do the same thing. You could just tap to one another, and you could share data that way. And that's kind of what you're saying here, but then much more fancy with glasses. Ah, you got a link. Awesome.
Yeah, unfortunately, it does not appear that the series has been released
okay.
in the U.S.
Okay, I got it. Yeah. So it's some sort of...
Well, I've just heard...
It's a really quite a wonderful story, though.
BBC's Digital Planet podcast just last week. They've been doing a special on Japan, and they've got a prototype there of we've all seen these things before, actually, these sort of... You know, glasses that have got the interface built into the glasses. In fact, they've existed for some time, but they've just never, they're too impractical. However, what they've done is they've attached to this eye tracking capability so that you can interact with the interface using just your eyes. So you can...
That sounds like ouch.
Oh, that would be so
Wouldn't
cool.
No, what do you mean? No, it's eye tracking, as in it's looking at your eyes and it's looking where your pupils are going, so that you can, just by looking at the interface in the glasses.
Yeah, I know, but try moving your eyes around all the time to do it. It'll get real painful real quick. I know it's, of course, just an idea. I know I'm just shooting down an idea here, but just a little. That wouldn't be very practical, I think.
Yeah, but it just shows the possibility
yeah.
of operating systems moving well beyond, obviously, the desktop, the traditional desktop thing. So it shows there's a lot of room in the future for operating systems certainly to change a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
And that this goes back to the whole embedded devices might, you know, slowly usurp the desktop space with a completely different use factor that feels utterly natural and will just
yeah,
take the place of what the desktop is today.
That would probably just ordinary laptops, where laptops started replacing normal desktops, not just
mm-hmm.
because laptops got more powerful, but also because they're more useful. You can take them to your friend, you can use them on the train, you can use them, well, not in the car, obviously, but you can use them while you're traveling, you can use them in many more places, and as devices get smaller and more powerful still. And I'm really waiting for the ARM netbooks, the Snapdragon, that sort of things, or the stuff that NVIDIA is doing with those massively long uptimes and everything. Yeah, you're probably right in that, you know, the traditional desktop is getting pushed away already, at least in the home. I mean, I'm not sure about companies and stuff because I don't really pay attention to that. But at least in the home, you know, traditional desktops get pushed away in favor of laptops, and probably laptops will get, not necessarily pushed away, but they'll be augmented more and more by devices like, you know, like iPhones, and for me, preferably more the SmartBook thing with what ARM is doing. So you're probably right on that one, right?
Yeah, you're going to have a division of tasks between not between applications, but between devices and between operating systems. You take Chrome OS, for example. I mean, there's a lot of things you can't do with it. I mean, you can't play a DVD with it. You can't run Skype on it.
Well, technically, you can't do anything with it. You can't do anything with it right
no,
now.
No, it doesn't
theory.
Yeah.
It doesn't I mean, exist
that's
yet.
The idea of having just a browser and nothing else, not having the capability of having anything else, it doesn't mean that the device is inadequate or it's going to be incapable of doing many things that people want to do with their computers. Most people's computers are only glorified internet boxes anyhow. But it's going to make our tasks, the things that we do, are going to be less and less applications and more individual devices. Already we've got that with what people are doing media center-wise with their Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3, etc. By centralizing, sorry, decentralizing those particular tasks to the individual devices that handle it better.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I suggest we wrap up this one and move to the final story that we want to cover because of time. We're at 1:35 right now. So we should probably move on. The Amazon story, right? About the whole DRM thing on the Kindle, and that's probably something that Crocs should start with because he actually suggested the story to me. So
I only passed on the Twitter link that I got, but it just obviously it's easy for us all to laugh at it. It's one of those funny things that happens on the internet. I would just recap for the listeners. Obviously, it is that Amazon has remote deleted books off of people's Kindles because the publisher of the book didn't properly have the rights for the book. So Amazon actually then went and deleted the copies that people had already purchased and then gave them a refund. Obviously, that's quite an extreme thing to do, but the irony level of it is just the fact that it was actually, of all books in the world that it could possibly be, it happened to be George Orwell's books, 1984 and Animal Farm. So we're all up in riots over that. But Amazon have apologised about the issue, and then they've also said that this won't happen again in the future. I wanted to pick up at that point there, because whilst it's something to say, okay, this won't happen again in the future, you have to understand that this kind of technology, this kind of capability to be able to remote delete people's content, it isn't default. You have to actually sit down and write that, and someone's got to design it, and someone's got to okay it, and some programmer's got to put in the capability. It's not like, oh, I'm sorry, we forgot to remove the functionality. The computer put it in there by default. Our programming language puts it in there by default, and we forgot to program it out. You have to add that.
Yeah.
So them, you know, them saying we're sorry, that's not good enough because you put it there in the first place. You shouldn't even have the capability to remote delete people's purchases.
Well, in addition to that, actually, we're all talking about 1984 and Animal Farm, but a lot of users have reported that other books have disappeared as well. So not just 1984 and Animal Farm. There were more, I believe, a lot of people were their Harry Potter books or something were deleted. Not that I would care about losing a Harry Potter book, but anyway.
Oh, crap. We just got an email from Adam saying he could be on the podcast, but I think it's a bit late for that now.
Well, maybe you could join in. Well, it's a bit late for that one.
Well, we could have rotating guests. There'll be times where I'll be in a plane on Sundays.
That wouldn't be a problem. Okay, where did I leave? I said something. Oh, yeah, that's where it was. So it weren't just the George Orwell books. Other books have disappeared as well. So Amazon stating this is a special case and it will never happen again. I'm sorry, but I just do not believe them. Because it's not the whole riot now is about 1984 and Animal Farm, but there are a lot more other titles have disappeared as well. So it's. I don't think this is an isolated incident, and I think that it may not be as obvious anymore, but stuff like this will happen again, because if they can delete stuff, they can also change things, and that's a scenario that I found really actually quite scary, because you would probably buy a certain book, maybe a history book or something, and then Amazon would have, technically, if they can delete something, they can also change it, so they have the capability to change your history books, and I find that
the blame in the right place.
Yeah, but on a philosophical level, I find that a very scary thing. Yeah.
Well, let's put the blame in the right place. sure, this is Amazon related, but ultimately this is pressure that's come from
obviously.
The reason these things exist is pressure from rights holders, and I think that's where all of the problem where this lies is. Amazon themselves may not inherently be that evil that they would want to do this anyway, but I think they've had difficulty in getting the device to exist in the first place unless they could comply with the rights holders. It was the same thing with Apple and doing iTunes. Apple managed to crack the formula only because they were belligerent enough to do something so audacious and get away with it. They obviously had to work very hard to put the DRM scheme together to please the rights holders, otherwise it would never have gone ahead in the first place. And now they've eventually managed to break that down and it's there isn't any DRM on it. The same thing is with this, and I think it's just a plain weakness from the manufacturers that they are giving in to these people. Sure, Amazon need the sales, and they need the books, and they need the content to be able to sell such a device, but the relationship is reciprocal. If a rights holder says to them, oh, we want these restrictions, these restrictions, and these restrictions, then Amazon should say, oh, I'm shame, sorry, you lost. And you know, and that's it. You play by our rules. We've got the device. We've got the market. We've got the people who are going to be buying your books. You play by our rules. None of this DRM rubbish, because we know it doesn't work.
Well, I think the problem with that one is that Amazon isn't a monopoly, not by a long shot even. So they don't have the kind of power to force rights holders to adapt to Amazon's and the customer's needs, especially since the Kindle is a very new device. It's not just even a new device like the iPod was. It's a completely new concept. It's a completely new thing. There has to be, you know, support for this thing, and awareness for an e-book reader has to be built completely from the ground up. I mean, there's basically. Well, there are other e-book readers out there, but technically the Kindle has the entire market for itself, and it's completely new, and I think even the whole experience is pretty revolutionary, but it's completely new, and the market is very small right now. So it's not that much of a loss for content providers on the book side of things to lose Kindle customers. I think that group is still too small to make that much of a difference on the bottom line for rights holders. So if they can demand more from Amazon than music companies can now demand from Apple, and I think that's kind of a problem. So Amazon has to give in more to the demands than Apple has had to do. So that's kind of a problem. So what we just got to hope is that the Kindle becomes very, very popular, but I won't be buying it anymore right now. It's not even available here anyway, so I wouldn't be able to buy it anyway. But it needs to become much more successful so that Amazon can put a lot more pressure on the rights holders to prevent stuff like this from actually happening.
It goes down to also the legality of purchases now being so damn vague. Because of the Euler issue, which is it's just an ongoing problem, and the fact that politicians and the government are not able to keep up fast enough with what's happening in the digital world. A lot of politicians don't even understand what open source is, let alone how to protect it. And so the problem is that the companies are appearing and rights holders are appearing, and they're making up their own rules in the digital world. There's no law as far as they're concerned.
Well,
they can make it up as they go along.
Technically, there's a lot of law on this one, because technically what applies is copyright law. That is what we have. Copyright law is what applies, and basically what companies are doing is restricting the rights that users have under copyright law, and that shouldn't be allowed, but as long as nobody's complaining about it, as long as nobody's starting any lawsuits and everything, nobody's going to care. So at least in the Netherlands, I'm pretty happy that a number of people have started suing the Dutch variant of the RIA. It's not technically exactly the same, but it comes down to being the same thing. And they're really challenging that now to get a definitive statement from the judges about our copyright laws and what it allows and what it does not allow. And that sort of stuff should start in a couple of years. Stuff like that will be happening all over the world, and governments will be forced to completely retool copyright laws and make it much more, at least I think it's going to end up being a lot more open, because you can just look at the success of, for instance, the Pirate Party in Sweden. They've got a seat on the fucking European Parliament. I mean, come on, that really just shows
that's like the monster raving loony party
here
in the UK.
but still, I mean, the success of that party really shows that there are a lot of people who care about this stuff. And the more people who care about this stuff, and you know, the Pirate Party, it's not just about getting stuff for free. That's not what this is about. This is about users, us as basically consumers, having certain rights. And as a Dutchman, I have certain rights under copyright law which allow me to download music even if the upload was illegal. That's a right that I have. It's been restated a number of times by our Secretary of Justice and the Secretary itself, so like the institution. So I have that right, and we have organizations like the RIA criminalizing me, even though it's not allowed, and people are getting ever more aware of that, and they're starting to revolt to that. And you see it in Sweden with the Pirate Party, and stuff like that is going to happen all around the world. I think maybe not in a couple of years, but at least in 10 years from now, stuff like that will be happening all over the world, and copyright laws will have to be loosened, not necessarily because people, not because the governments want to, but because they come completely unenforceable due to the relative ease with which you can share content now. So, you know, I'm really happy with that is happening right now.
And I would add that copyright reform is actually going to make these companies a lot more money than they've ever had before, as much as they're afraid of it. Take the case of the whole VHS in the 1980s, Betamax and VHS case, which invented fair use. Now, the thing is they were obviously very afraid of people being able to just tape any old stuff, and that would then prevent people going to the cinema and seeing films, and it would make piracy rampant because anybody could pirate anything easily. And so this went to court, and you had the whole Betamax, Sony themselves, who we now consider to be one of our enemies as far as copyright, went to the high courts to actually defend fair use and to defend their product, the Betamax. And they won in the end, but not before, unfortunately, they had lost out to VHS in the format war. But ultimately, it meant that fair use was created, and people had the right to exchange things. And then, surprise, surprise, the home video market ended up generating more cash than cinemas ever did.
Yeah. So if the more... that's actually a really good example, but... I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. What we're seeing now are the last stuiptrekkingen, that's what we call them in Dutch, but the last twitches of a dying concept, basically, namely the whole media companies and having them control the entire supply, and now the entire supply chain, that's what I was looking for. So they used to control the entire supply chain, but that's gone now, that control. And what we're seeing now are the last twitches of this format of this concept, trying to retain that idea through lawsuits and multi-million fines against grandmas who download a couple of songs for their grandchildren. And that's just going away. I mean, the more ridiculous these lawsuits get, the more people will revolt against them. So they're not really, basically with all these lawsuits and these ridiculous behavior of these companies and their organizations, really just only speed up the
accelerates
process, accelerate the process of people turning against the media company. So they could have saved themselves a couple of years ago by being much more open and much more tolerant about all this, and that they could have made a lot more money now than they could have made a lot more money than they are making now. And the fun bit is that even a lot of studies are showing that CD sales aren't going down at all. They're in fact going up because people are discovering more music through the internet and then buying music, and the same goes for films and TV series because
Oh, absolutely. I can't tell you the number of artists I picked up just recently by listening to Last FM.
Artists who buy their music. And they could have capitalized on it. They could have set up an entire discovery service where all the media companies even work together by making some sort of platform for new artists to come out. And they would have been able to make a lot more money than they are doing now with these stupid lawsuits and all that nonsense. It's a shame, basically. It could have been really good for music, and it is actually really good for music right now because of all the Creative Commons stuff that's coming out. But all that stuff that's now being published through Creative Commons, the media companies could have had that market, basically, if they would have been more open in the past and would have embraced the new distribution method instead of trying to kill it with lawsuits and everything. So it's just their loss, not mine, basically.
Let's have a look at time. Well, let's get back on to the topic of Amazon and try and wrap this up.
Okay. Is there anything you got to add on this one, Tess? Or
It just seems like a colossal amount of fail. They sacrificed their users' happiness for making the publisher happy. And admittedly, they needed to make the publishers happy in order to even get the Kindle device off the ground. And I'm not sure how viable a dedicated ebook reader is going to be in the future if we have proper low-power display technologies and we integrate those into handheld smartphones. I mean, what's the point in having a Kindle? You just have your phone, and if it has a big enough screen, you read things off of it, and you can do one-click purchases right off of the device.
Amazon holds the patent
that would
for
be
that.
Pretty nifty, but we're not quite
Amazon
there yet.
Amazon holds the
patent for that. Yeah, for the one-click, for the whole one-click purchase thing. But yeah, well, of course, conversion is always going to happen. Well,
two clicks.
Themselves in the foot here, because they're saying that e-books are exactly the same, but more than normal books, but they're not, because you're not buying those books.
Because they cost more.
You're loaning your books, and that's and if that idea gets enough attention, then people won't be buying Kindles; they'll be sticking to their books, because when you buy a book, it's yours, and technically, there's absolutely nothing that states that buying a digital copy shouldn't give you the exact same rights, namely the rights to give your book to someone else, your ebook to someone else, or to, you know, to scribble notes in it and whatever. And it's all sorts of stuff that people won't be buying a Kindle if they realize that their ebooks are not the same as normal books. And I think someone made a brilliant comment on that one. It could even be the first comment. Oh yeah, here. Actually, electronic books are equal to hard copies of books. It's just that some copies are more equal than others. That basically sums up the entire thing here. And
well, Amazon chose a really good way to cock up, because it is going to bring this whole problem of ownership to the forefront.
1984. I mean, there's someone at Amazon who was, you know, who oversees this whole thing, or maybe some guy in an office somewhere. And he got the request from to please take down the copies of these and these books and make sure they're deleted from Kindles. I just don't understand. I imagine that guy sitting at his desk like, yes, let's delete 1984 automatically from all people's Kindles. Yeah, that's a pretty good idea. Let's do that. I mean, how stupid do you have to be to not see that backlash in some way or the other? that could be possible.
Well, they might have not ever read it. Or even saw one of the many horrible movie versions of it.
Perhaps Amazon don't let employees access to such information. It would be bad for them.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I think we should probably wrap this podcast up, because we're approaching the 2-hour mark right here.
Yay!
A lot of editing work for you, and you've got to deal with 3 streams instead of 2, and I don't envy you.
Fun. Now, we've managed to do it all in one cut, so this should be real easy.
Oh, okay, good.
At least I hope so, anyway. And, of course, we hope that the readers enjoy it as well. If you complain, if it's too long, then by all means complain.
We've had no complaints.
That's what the website's for.
We've had no complaints about length, have we?
Not one.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, I actually took a look at in Google Reader. There's apparently 47 subscribers through Google Reader, at least, to the podcast directly.
We can't see that, can we?
No, we don't know that figure. We'll have to ask and try and find out an exact figure, because we have no idea what our listenership is.
Yeah, we also don't know anything about our own RSS feed in that regard, so it's kind of problematic. Well, we haven't...
How much hate mail we're going to get.
We've only got the login from people.
No.
So that's pretty cool.
Okay, let's catch up the final matter. Email, if you'd like to contribute anything to the show, anything you would like to say about this week's show, please email us at osnews-crew@osnews.com.
And we'll be sure to forward the emails that we get to you, Tess, so that you will be able to see the same things. Because you're obviously not subscribed to the OS News Crew mailing list, but I'll make sure you get the same emails that we do regarding the podcast. Don't worry about that.
Okay, thank you.
If you've got anything to say to Tessa as well, yes, please include that in your email, because we're happy to forward that. We were very happy for you to have been on the show.
That's,
I think it's really added a lot to it, especially the fact that just time-wise.
Yeah, definitely.
Twitter. You may follow us on Twitter, although what we say on Twitter really has nothing to do with OS news. We may mention it on occasion. I'm at twitter.com/croc, that's K-R-O-C.
I'm at /TomHoda, and as always, the spelling is on the website. And I'm not sure if Tess has a Twitter account, actually.
I've got several, actually. there is one for Deninet, it's just DENINET.com.
Okay.
Okay, excellent. That's about everything, isn't it? Good night.
Yeah, well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you all listen again next time, and good night, basically.